Hi, I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! For more than 15 years, CJSF 90.1 FM has been bringing Democracy Now! To the greater Vancouver area every weekday at 11 a.m. This is Democracy Now!
I thought it was critical that there would not be any doubt, none whatsoever, about U.S. support for Ukraine and their war against the brutal attack by Russia. No, it's good to be back in Kyiv.
As President Biden makes a surprise visit to Ukraine, on this week's one-year anniversary of Russia's invasion, we look at calls for a diplomatic end to the war with Code Pink's Medea Benjamin and Matt Duss, visiting scholar at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. Then the Munich Security Conference this weekend hosts Vice President Kamala Harris. She accuses Russia of committing crimes against humanity.
And I say, to all those who have perpetrated these crimes, and to their superiors who are complicit in these crimes, you will be held to account.
We'll get response from Reed Brody in Geneva, war crimes prosecutor, former counsel for Human Rights Watch, author of To Catch a Dictator. And as the Centers for Disease Control warns teen girls face record levels of depression and hopelessness, we look at the role of social media.
As my screen time increased, my mental and physical health suffered. The constant quantification of my worth through likes, comments, and followers heightened my anxiety and deepened my depression. As a young woman, the constant exposure to unrealistic body standards and harmful recommended content led me towards disordered eating and severely damaged my sense of self.
We'll look at calls to hold big tech companies accountable for harmful marketing and platform design choices. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. President Biden landed in Ukraine earlier today, where he met with President Volodymyr Zelensky and announced a new wave of sanctions against Russia, along with another $500 million in U.S. assistance, including more military weapons.
I'm here to show our unwavering support for the nation's independence, our sovereignty, and territorial integrity.
Air raid sirens blared as Biden visited Kyiv. The surprise visit came just days ahead of the first anniversary of Russia's invasion of Ukraine, February 24th. Biden's increased weapons commitment comes after the head of the European Commission said the bloc would take extraordinary measures to ramp up the production, purchase and supply of weapons to Ukraine. Ursula von der Leyen made the pledge during this weekend's Munich Security Conference, while intense battles continued in eastern Ukraine. Outside Munich, hundreds of people gathered to protest.
Because it is simply important that we cannot permanently supply weapons, because then the war does not stop. Every day that weapons are supplied, people die on both sides. And these people count. It is important to go into peace negotiations.
Also at the Munich Security Conference, Vice President Kamala Harris accused Russia of crimes against humanity in Ukraine. Both Harris and Secretary of State Antony Blinken warned China against providing support to Moscow. As reports emerge, Beijing is supplying Russian forces with non-lethal military assistance. Beijing responded to the U.S. threats earlier today.
It is the U.S., not China, that is providing a steady stream of weapons on the battlefield. The United States is in no position to make demands of China. We will never accept the U.S. pointing fingers at Sino-Russian relations or even coercing us.
Japan has requested an emergency meeting of the UN Security Council after North Korea test-fired an intercontinental ballistic missile into the sea off Japan's coast Saturday. North Korea fired two more long-range missiles earlier today. North Korea said the launches are a warning to the U.S. and South Korea as they prepare for joint military drills. Top diplomats of Japan, South Korea, and the U.S. held emergency meetings on the sidelines of the Munich Security Conference and threatened further isolation of Pyongyang.
North Korea will face more severe sanctions by the international community. Pyongyang will gain nothing from its provocations.
Turkey says it's wrapping up rescue operations in all but two provinces, 2 weeks after a pair of massive earthquakes and their aftershocks devastated Turkey and neighboring Syria. The death toll now tops 46,000, expected to keep rising as more bodies are discovered. This weekend, the Ghanaian soccer star Christian Atsu was confirmed as one of the victims. The 31-year-old Atsu played for a Turkish club and previously for teams in Saudi Arabia and Britain. Christian Atsu's body was repatriated to Ghana as tributes poured in, with his former soccer clubs in the UK holding a minute's applause before their weekend games. Meanwhile, a union representing architects and engineers in Turkey condemned the government and local authorities for ignoring their warnings about issues with building construction and their pleas for stronger regulations. In Israel, thousands of protesters have taken to the streets, blocking roads, massing in front of the Knesset in Jerusalem as the far-right government of Benjamin Netanyahu pushes ahead on highly contested legislation that would greatly disempower Israel's judiciary. On Saturday, an estimated 250,000 people took to the streets of Tel Aviv and other cities to protest the plan for the seventh consecutive week. In Syria, at least 15 people were killed and a number of homes were destroyed early Sunday as Israel launched airstrikes on the capital, Damascus. The bombings leveled a 10-story building and left behind a massive crater in a district that's home to senior Syrian government officials. It's believed to be Israel's deadliest attack on Syria since the start of the civil war nearly 12 years ago. Elsewhere, the U.S. Military Central Command, CENTCOM, says it's killed ISIS leader Hamza al-Homsi during an assault in northeastern Syria Thursday. Four U.S. soldiers were reportedly injured in the helicopter raid. The assault came as Syria's government said 53 people were shot and killed by ISIS fighters after an ambush in Homs province last week. In Bulgaria, 18 Afghan refugees were found dead Friday inside an abandoned truck near the capital. Six Bulgarians have been indicted, including the alleged leader of a smuggling group. 34 others rescued, including five children, who remain hospitalized for carbon monoxide poisoning from inhaling exhaust fumes. The refugees were headed to Western Europe. Bulgaria's harsh immigration policies are forcing people to rely on more dangerous methods, and refugees have accused Bulgarian security forces of abuse. The Tunisian president, Kais Saied, has ordered Europe's top trade union official to leave Tunisia after she took part in a protest organized by a powerful labor union Saturday. This is the secretary general of Tunisia's general labor union, Othman Jalouli, speaking at the protest.
There's an inability of the government and the authorities to put the country on the right track on the economic, social, and political levels. Today, there's a campaign aimed at undermining the union and silencing the voice of workers with the intention of passing unpopular policies.
The UN's human rights chief last week warned against a mounting crackdown in Tunisia, where President Saied's government has arrested officials from the main opposition party, ENADA, former ministers, judges, lawyers, and the head of a radio station. In July 2021, Saied dismissed the government-declared rule by decree and vowed to rewrite Tunisia's constitution. In southeastern Brazil, at least three dozen people were killed over the weekend as heavy rains triggered landslides and flash flooding in the coastal Sao Paulo state. Some areas received more than 2 feet of rain in just 24 hours in what meteorologists called an unprecedented extreme weather event. In New Zealand, at least 11 people are dead and thousands remain unaccounted for 1 week after Cyclone Gabrielle left a trail of devastation along New Zealand's North Island. Prime Minister Chris Hipkins blamed climate change for the scale of the damage, calling it New Zealand's worst natural disaster of the century. Meanwhile, Madagascar is bracing for Cyclone Freddy, 1 month after a devastating tropical storm killed 30 people. Freddy's an extremely rare and long-lived cyclone, just the third ever recorded crossing the Indian Ocean. Here in the United States, at least 77 people held at two Immigration and Customs Enforcement detention centers in California have launched a hunger strike demanding the facilities shut down and release all prisoners. The hunger strike is an extension of an ongoing labor protest led by people held at the Mesa Verde Golden State ICE jails who are paid just $1 a day for their work, including janitorial services where they've been exposed to black mold. Officials at the detention centers, which are operated by the private prison contractor GEO Group, have retaliated against the strikers by putting them in solitary confinement. Meanwhile, a new report by the group Innovation Law Lab describes immigrants and asylum seekers held at the Torrance County Detention Facility in New Mexico are being subjected to torturous methods, including solitary confinement, sleep deprivation, medical neglect, and severe due process violations that led to wrongful deportations. In related news, the immigrant justice group, Al Otro Lado, have sued CoreCivic for the wrongful death of Anthony Jones, a Bahamian man who died of a heart attack at the Adams County Detention Center in Mississippi in December 2020. The suit says staff failed to send him to the hospital and waited at least 9 minutes before administering CPR. In Memphis, five former police officers pleaded not guilty Friday to murdering Tyre Nichols. Their brutal beating of the 29-year-old black father caught on tape led to his death 3 days later. Tyre Nichols' mother, Rovon Wells, spoke after the arraignment.
I know my son is gone. I know I'll never see him again. But we have to start this process of justice right now. And I want each and every one of those police officers to be able to look me in the face. They haven't done that yet.
In northern Mississippi, a man armed with a shotgun and two handguns went on a killing spree Friday, fatally shooting his ex-wife, stepfather, stepsister, and three other people before police finally arrested him. The massacre came in a small town south of Memphis, Tennessee, where on Sunday one person was killed and 10 others wounded by gunfire at a nightclub in a nearby residence. Meanwhile, police in Columbus, Georgia, responded to calls of a shooting at a gas station Friday, where they found 9 children injured with gunshot wounds. And in Linden, New Jersey, 4 family members are dead in an apparent murder-suicide. Investigators believe the father fired on his wife and 2 teenage children Sunday before turning the gun on himself. According to the Gun Violence Archive, there have been 80 mass shootings in the United States since January 1st. Fox News hosts and top executives, including Fox Corporation head Rupert Murdoch, thought former President Donald Trump's 2020 election fraud claims were completely unfounded, yet continued to push his conspiracy theories on the air. The revelations come in a series of emails, text messages, and testimony detailed in a court filing as part of the Dominion Voting System's $1.6 billion defamation lawsuit against Fox News. Fox News repeatedly reported Dominion change votes to hand Biden the win. Star hosts Tucker Carlson, Sean Hannity, and Laura Ingraham were all named in the filing. Among the charges, the filing says Tucker Carlson wrote fellow primetime host Laura Ingraham saying, "Trump's lawyer, Sidney Powell, is lying, by the way. I caught her. It's insane," he wrote. Carlson and Hannity also allegedly wanted to get Fox reporters who fact-checked Trump's election claims fired. Fox News hosts and executives are cited as calling Trump's election fraud lies, quote, "mind-blowingly nuts, totally off the rails, and completely BS." And Jimmy Carter has entered hospice care at his home in Plains, Georgia, turning down any more medical treatment after a recent series of hospitalizations. He was diagnosed with cancer in 2015. The 98-year-old Nobel Peace Laureate is the longest-living president in U.S. history and known for his active post-presidency, including his work with Habitat for Humanity and the Carter Center. He most recently joined efforts to protect the Izembek National Wildlife Refuge in Alaska. To see our interviews with President Carter, go to democracynow.org. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As the war in Ukraine approaches the one-year mark this week, President Biden made a surprise visit to Ukraine today. During a meeting with the Ukrainian president, Volodymyr Zelensky, in Kyiv, Biden announced a new wave of sanctions against Russia and another $500 million in assistance, including more military equipment.
I thought it was critical that there would not be any doubt, none whatsoever, about U.S. support for Ukraine in their war against the brutal attack by Russia. And our hearts could be back in Kyiv.
Biden's increased weapons commitment comes after the head of the European Commission said the bloc would take extraordinary measures to ramp up the production, purchase and supply of weapons to Ukraine. Ursula von der Leyen made the pledge during this weekend's Munich Security Conference while intense battles continued along the front in eastern Ukraine. Outside the conference, hundreds of people gathered to protest.
Because it is simply important that we cannot permanently supply weapons, because then the war does not stop. Every day that weapons are supplied, people die on both sides. And these people count. It is important to go into peace negotiations.
Before President Biden left for Ukraine, he was met with protests during his dinner this weekend in Washington, D.C., by an activist with the anti-war group Code Pink.
President Biden, I hate to bother you. We need to end this war in Ukraine. We need to push through negotiations. I hate to bother you, but people are dying.
Sunday in Washington, D.C., there was also a Rage Against the War Machine protest at the Lincoln Memorial, where former Green Party presidential candidate Jill Stein and others spoke. For more on Biden's surprise trip to Ukraine today, we're joined in Washington, D.C. by two guests. Medea Benjamin is co-founder of Code Pink, co-author of the new book War in Ukraine, Making Sense of a Senseless Conflict. Also with us, Matt Duss, visiting scholar at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, former foreign policy advisor to Senator Bernie Sanders and co-author of a piece in the New Republic headlined A Better Biden Doctrine. We welcome you both back to Democracy Now! Matt Duss, let's begin with you. Your response to this surprise visit before the announced visit to Poland that President Biden made today, meeting with Volodymyr Zelensky in the Ukrainian capital, Kyiv.
Sure, and thanks for inviting me on. I think the visit by President Biden to Kyiv is, you know, clearly intended just to show continuing support and solidarity with the people of Ukraine as we approach the one-year anniversary of the, you know, the Russian invasion or the Russian further invasion on February 24th. And I think, you know, for an American president to make a trip like this is enormously symbolic. If on all days on President's Day to make an appearance with Ukraine's president. So I think, you know, coming after, you know, days after we've seen a number of senior administration officials making speeches and holding consultations at the Munich Security Conference, working with allies and partners, to show continuing support. I think the president's visit really underlines that in an important way.
And the announcement of more, something like $500 million of weapons to Ukraine, mainly?
I think, you know, the release of further funds that have been already allocated is important. I think it, you know, but the president also did not commit to, to sending the advanced forms of long-range weapons that the Ukrainians have continued to request. And I think it does show the way the president has approached this problem with a really important measure of restraint. The last point I would make is last week we saw a report in The Washington Post about, you know, various administration officials in conversations with their Ukrainian counterparts, making clear that, you know, there should be an opportunity sometime in the next few months, hopefully, for the possibility to find an opportunity to get to negotiations. They are very mindful that the United States and its partners cannot continue to supply Ukraine at the current rate. So I think that article we saw last week signaled an effort to start to prepare the environment for eventual negotiations.
This is President Biden speaking in Kyiv before he left.
Together, we've committed nearly 700 tanks and thousands of armored vehicles, 1,000 artillery systems, more than 2 million rounds of artillery ammunition, more than 50 advanced launch rocket systems, anti-ship and air defense systems, all defend Ukraine. And that doesn't count the other half $1 billion we're announcing with you today and tomorrow. That's going to be coming your way. And that's just the United States in this piece. And just today, that announcement includes artillery ammunition for HIMARS and howitzers, more javelins, anti-armor systems, air surveillance radars to help protect Ukrainian people from aerial bombardments. Later this week, we will announce additional sanctions against elites and companies that are trying to evade sanctions and backfill Russia's war machine.
That's President Biden speaking in a surprise trip to Kyiv this morning before heading on to Warsaw, Poland. We're also joined by Medea Benjamin, co-founder of Code Pink. Medea, your response to President Biden's trip and to the statement that he just made.
Well, I feel this is a propaganda move to shore up support for a senseless war that the American public are starting to realize has no end in sight except for more senseless waste of lives. We saw a new AP poll that showed that only 40% of the American people want to send more weapons to Ukraine. We see protests happening here in the United States, like the one that happened yesterday, bringing together a broad sector of people. And we see the protests happening all over Europe. A new coalition called Europe for Peace that is pushing their governments towards negotiations. And we see just from the United States the opposite from Biden, saying we're sending more weapons. And of course, Zelensky, every time the U.S. agrees to send a new weapon like the tanks, then has another request like the fighter jets. And what is it going to be after that? Troops. The American public, the public in Europe and the world community is saying we need to find an answer for this. That is why the top diplomat from China is on his way to Russia. They are about to announce a peace plan. The entire world is calling for a peace plan. We saw this with President Lula from Brazil, who met with Biden. Biden was pushing Brazil to send weapons to Ukraine. He said, we don't want to join this war. We want to end this war.
Matt Duss, your response to Medea Benjamin's comment that this is a senseless war.
I agree it's a senseless war. It's a senseless war that was launched by Russian President Vladimir Putin. I would agree that we all want to end this war. I think the people who want to end this war most of all are the Ukrainians. I think the question is, under what conditions can we end this war in a way that's durable and that provides for continuing security and not is simply a pause before we get to another round of even worse fighting? I think this has been the approach of the Biden administration thus far, is to get to a point where you have real negotiations that can produce a ceasefire, if not a peace agreement, an actual ceasefire that is enforceable and durable. And I certainly grant that there are very legitimate concerns and questions on the part of lots of people, including within the administration, about how long this can go on. And continuing to seek opportunities for precisely the negotiations that I previously mentioned.
Matt, Ukraine's president, Volodymyr Zelensky, has said he's ruling out trading territory for peace as part of any negotiated settlement with Putin. He made the comments in an interview with the BBC. Your response?
I think from Zelensky's perspective, it makes sense for him to say that. And I will also recognize that as a matter of international law, all of Ukraine, including Crimea, is part of Ukraine. Now, if we get to a point where, there's a ceasefire that is possible and durable in the absence of those kind of maximalist goals, I think that is something that we should look at seriously. I'm not proposing to negotiate on the behalf of the Ukrainians. No one should do that. But I do think we do have an interest in seeking, an end to this war. And I think the administration is clear about that, even if they very carefully do not want to get ahead, at least publicly, of declarations from the Ukrainian president.
Medea Benjamin, if you could respond to what Matt says, and you talked about the anti-war protest yesterday in Washington, D.C. You were initially on the scheduled to speak, but then you didn't speak. I was looking at a series of tweets between you and Ralph Nader, and he said, why didn't you speak? Can you explain what's happening within the anti-war movement? But first, respond to Matt.
I think the U.S. has a history of trying to stop negotiations, especially the ones that were taking place in March, a month after the war began, and the West decided that they didn't want Zelensky to make an agreement with Russia. I think that the constant sending of weapons is saying to Zelensky, you don't have to negotiate. We are behind you 100%. The U.S., what it should be doing is talking to the Russians. Biden, instead of making a symbolic appearance in Kyiv, should make a meeting with Putin, and they should talk about how to end this war. The issue of yesterday's march, rally, and then a march to the White House. It was fascinating, Amy. I've never been at an anti-war rally like that. My organization, Code Pink, didn't want me to speak there because they didn't like a number of the speakers and their positions on other issues. But when have we ever had an anti-war march that brought together Ron Paul, Tulsi Gabbard, Jill Stein, Dennis Kucinich, people from very different political perspectives? And there is another march coming up on March 18th, which a different set of groups is putting together. I think we have to be at every anti-war march. And I'm also excited that on Tuesday we're having a lobby day in Congress, inviting people of all political persuasions to come meet us in the Rayburn Building and go to the offices of every member of the Armed Services Committee in Congress to say enough weapons, stop sending weapons, start negotiating, stop escalating, start negotiating. This is the message I think now that more and more American people want us to take to Congress, which has done nothing but supply billions and billions of weapons to keep this war going when there is no winning on the battlefield. And I think that's an important thing to say to you, Matt Duss, because there is no winning on the battlefield. If you agree to that, then why do we keep fueling this war?
Matt, your response.
Sure. I mean, first, I would just quickly, reference something Medea just said about the United States stopping negotiations. She referenced talks that were happening in March and in April. And I think I would encourage, viewers to look closely into that, because I think that's a very, very incomplete and frankly, inaccurate, rendition of what actually happened in that situation in those negotiations between the Ukrainians and the Russians. With regard to ending the war, as I said, I want this war to end. Ukrainians certainly want this war to end. I think acknowledging that there can be no victory on the battlefield, even if one does acknowledge that, there is still an argument for continuing to support the Ukrainians for creating the best possible situation on the battlefield that they can to come into negotiations from the strongest possible position. That has been, I think, the Biden administration's approach. That has been the approach of our European allies. That does not preclude eventual negotiations when those negotiations become possible. I would note also that the Biden administration has been talking to the Russians at various levels, even if we're not seeing phone calls between President Biden and President Putin. There's been numerous reports of contacts at various levels between United States officials and their counterparts to identify when negotiations are appropriate and can achieve something. But as yet, Vladimir Putin is the one who has given no indication that he is ready for that. And I think that's very important to recognize.
That's just not true, Matt. And going back to the negotiations that were happening in March, it was not only confirmed by Turkish officials involved in the negotiations and Ukrainians themselves, but now we have former Prime Minister Naftali Bennett from Israel saying that the West blocked these negotiations. And in terms of the negotiations, I think it's very exciting that now we have the Chinese who are on their way to talk to Putin in Russia and will be announcing a peace plan. And I think the Chinese are representing what the entire world wants to see. Stop the fighting now. You say, when will it be time for negotiations? Well, the time for negotiations is way past due. And I think the pressure to send fighter jets, I mean, we're just getting deeper and deeper into a third world war